This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, coming to you on the day after a historic nomination in U.S. politics. Senator Kamala Harris of California could now become Vice President Kamala Harris. After months of speculation, presumptive Democratic nominee for President Joe Biden chose the former California Attorney General and current senator as his running mate. Harris is a Black woman of Jamaican and Indian descent and also the first woman of color to be nominated for vice president by a major party. And as always, we wanted to give you the first word.
I am so excited about Kamala Harris being chosen for Biden's VP nominee. I can't wait because she's a butt kicker and she is a woman of color and she does not back down. I think it's fantastic. And she'll even maybe tap him and say, Joe, quit sniffing my hair. This is Nikki from Arlington, Texas.
This is Kate Kevern in Eugene, Oregon, and I am not at all happy about Joe Biden picking Kamala Harris as his running mate because the Black Lives Matter movement is really getting traction, and also this violent police have to stop. And she just has such a horrible record on policing. She's the last person I wanted him to pick.
She's smart, she's tough, and she won't back down. Go, Kamala. This is Barbara in your neighboring city of San Jose.
Hi, this is Tom from Glendale. What's to think? We've got our ticket, and it's strong, and it's solid, and we're going to be winning the White House and hopefully the U.S. Senate.
This is Julie Motz from Fairfax, California. I was not surprised, but I was still disappointed to see Joe Biden pick Kamala Harris as his running mate. He missed an opportunity to have some really dynamic Black women like Karen Bass or Barbara Lee, people who really have fought very hard for human rights and for civil rights and who are real firebrands, which is what I think he needs in the campaign. I think Kamala Harris is too polite, too calm, too interested in being seen in a certain way. I don't think she's the kind of fighter for our rights that we need, and I'm very sorry that he made the choice.
Thanks for your calls at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Kat Stafford is the Associate Press Reporter on Race and Ethnicity, and Maya King covers race, ethnicity, and campaigns for Politico. Maya, let's start with you. Why do you think ultimately Biden chose Harris as his running mate?
Well, you know, Tanzina, I think that Harris really checks the boxes, both for those who were hoping for the historic choice, so a woman of color on the ticket, and those who were hoping for a strong, viable candidate. I mean, Harris, one phrase that I keep hearing is that she's ready on day one. And another phrase that I've heard is that she's battle tested. Folks have seen her on the campaign trail. They know what she brings. They know the connections that she brings. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, Joe Biden kind of looked at a lot of the options that he had and saw in Harris someone who's not only able to bring together further shoring up the support that he needs at the margins within the party, but also someone who can definitely hold her own on a debate stage and be able to lead and really hold her own in the White House if they do win in November.
Kat, let's bring you in here because Kamala's nomination is historic. She's the first Black woman and also the first woman of Indian descent to be nominated for vice president here in this country. What do you think that is going to convey to voters?
The power of this moment cannot be overstated, first off. I think what this conveys to voters, especially Black women in this moment, who for the past several months have really been telling the party, look, it's our time to lead. It's time for our voices to be heard. It's time for you to recognize all of our contributions dating back to the civil rights movement and honestly before that, right? I think in this moment what this shows is that the party is listening to these voters. They recognize the impact that they could have and will have on the November election. And I think that the party is hoping that this is a signal of, you know, we hear you. We see what you're saying. But I just want to point out, you know, I had a story that published this morning and one woman, a Black woman in Detroit, she told me that for her, it speaks to the fact that this tells little Black girls, little girls of color across the nation, across the world, really, that they can too hope to achieve to become the president of the United States of America.
And Kat, one of the things that is noted is often Kamala's Black heritage. She, her father is of Jamaican descent. She went to Howard University. She's a member of the National AKA sorority. Less talked about is her Indian heritage. Why do you think that is?
That's a good question, and I think it's an important point to make. I believe, at least in my own reporting, that it's important to note all of her heritage. I mean, she has spoken deeply about her bond with her late mother and how really she was her single largest influence in her life. So I think it's crucial for us to recognize that and to point that out. But also, you know, at the AP, we had a long discussion about this. You know, how do we characterize her? And I think that's something that all newsrooms need to have frank discussions about. And we decided to recognize the fact that she identifies herself as a Black woman while also recognizing her Asian American heritage as well. So I think that her selection, though, while my story focused heavily on what it means to Black women, to Black voters, I have seen so many people of color from various groups across the country who are excited about this selection.
Maya, you know, one of the things that has come up for then presidential candidate Kamala Harris has her background on criminal justice issues. Protests against police brutality have obviously continued over the past couple of months. But this felt to me, Maya, very much like the Democratic Party was saying, we're not as far left as you would like us to be. We're going to appeal to more of a moderate centrist voter with the Kamala pick. Do you see that, particularly given her record on criminal justice?
I do. And I think it's interesting because a lot of the discourse around her pick in the immediate wake of it has been saying that she would shore up Black support. But to your point, you know, having Harris on the ticket does not make Black support a given. When she was a presidential candidate, Harris broke through with African-American voters barely in the top three. And part of the reason why that was owing to her prosecutorial record. And as you also mentioned, you know, we're seeing now, we're entering our third month of widespread protests against racism and against police violence. I've already heard from folks who are involved in activist movements and those who are, you know, members of the more progressive flank of the Democratic Party who aren't really excited about seeing Harris on the ticket because of her record on policing and because of the role that she played in mass incarceration in California. These are the things that people are pointing to and are the things that they'll be looking to Harris and to Biden, quite frankly, to answer to and not necessarily smooth over. But I think now the time will come for them to start to make some commitments and understand that they might not have the support that they need right now, but there are some things that they're going to have to do and even rectify to show that they have an understanding of the legacy and the role that they've played in the legacy of criminal justice in this country.
Kat, when you look at the, what Maya just said and sort of looking at the political calculus that I'm sort of assuming that Biden made here with this pick, because we know that this wasn't just something that was, you know, they plucked it out of the air. This was a really, really calculated decision. Is vice presidential candidate Harris at this point, presumptive VP candidate Harris, going to have to appeal to more progressive demographics? And if so, how do you see her being able to do that?
Oh, absolutely. That's going to be crucial between now and November. We know that while Joe Biden has an overwhelming amount of support among older Black Americans, that support among younger Black voters, among younger Latino voters, it's not quite there. And a lot of the conversations that I had last night, while many, as I had pointed out earlier, were excited, others, you know, were kind of cautious. Some people were outright upset, given what Maya detailed in terms of Harris's past record. But I spoke with some of the leading activists who pointed out that they see this as a potential opportunity, as an opportunity to connect with her. They're hopeful that this will be a way for them to really drill down and press Biden to address some of these criminal justice reforms that they have long been advocating for. I spoke with Rashad Robinson from Color of Change, and he said over time, she has kind of evolved. She has become more progressive in her ideals. But as Alicia Garza, the co-founder of Black Lives Matter, told me, it's nice to see a Black woman be on the ticket. It's historic. But what's really going to matter is the substance and what comes of it. So I think Kamala Harris, as well as Joe Biden, because he's going to have to be a part of this. It should not all be on her, is what many are saying. They're going to have to find a way to bring those folks who are out in the streets into the vote and feel as if this party is really for them.
Maya, at the top of the segment, we heard yesterday, I reached out to folks on Twitter, basically asking women of color specifically their thoughts on this. But we then broadened the conversation to our listeners, and we heard a lot of different points of view. There are people who are thrilled that Harris is the presumptive VP nominee. There are people who are not happy at all because of particularly the record, her criminal justice record. So, Maya, do we have any polling that indicates how people actually feel about Kamala Harris?
Well, the polling that we have for now is what we've been really looking at is how people felt leading up to her pick. And among those who were inside the vice president's team of advisors and folks who were gunning for an African-American woman on the ticket, I do know that Harris was really a top choice. I will be interested in seeing now, the next round of polls that come out to actually suggest if that holds up on the ground and among members of the electorate. Though from who I've talked to and what I've seen, I do imagine that she will be well received. I think right now what we're seeing is that kind of gut punch reaction that folks have to her immediate selection. But this week is really going to be crucial, and the next few weeks will be as we start to see what a Biden-Harris ticket really looks like, what their priorities will actually be. We've already seen the team that they've assembled that's been very strong and very well received. And the fact that they're making history is something I think that will bode well for them in the polls, and that will bode well for Harris in the polls. But I mean, the big elephant in the room and the thing that we keep talking about, of course, is the fact that we have a ticket of a former federal prosecutor and also the architect of the 94 crime bill. So, as we've said, there will be a lot of talks and a lot of answering too that will have to happen on this ticket, though. What I do understand, and from what I've seen, I do think that this will be a pretty well-received ticket among Democrats.
Kat, Harris is also the child of immigrant parents, one from India, one from Jamaica. What does that bring to the ticket when it comes to the immigration debate in this country?
I think it brings someone to the table who has the right perspective, potentially, that Democrats are really looking for to kind of bring that conversation back to the forefront. You know, with the pandemic going on, with the national reckoning around race and police brutality, the immigration debate has largely kind of fallen toward the background, at least in media coverage. But we know for many people living in this country, it is a daily reality. It's something that they are thinking about every moment, right? So with her having this background, with her having this perspective of having immigrant parents, the hope is that she will be able to bring much needed perspective and by chance also uplift some of these voices that have been missing from this conversation.
Maya, let's talk a little bit about the relationship between Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. They've known each other. Harris knew Biden's son, Beau. What else do we know?
Well, we do know that Harris played a key role in campaigning for Biden and Obama in 2008 and in 2012. As you mentioned, Harris was very close with Beau Biden. And there were a lot of conversations, of course, before she was the ultimate vice presidential pick around whether or not she would be viable because of the run-in that Joe Biden and Harris had on the debate stage in July of 2019 during the first presidential debate, where she kind of railed into him about his record of fraternizing with segregationists. And folks that I talked to in the story that I published last night, they kind of told me, look, you know, this is politics. And it's really, that was an overblown rumor. Biden and Harris have a very close relationship. My colleagues also wrote about this and said that, of course, it was acknowledged that was a point of contention between the two, However, you know, it really wasn't something that was going to get in the way, ultimately, as we've seen, of her relationship with Biden, and that it was strong. Of course, even leading up to it, we saw a number of the notes that Biden had for his speeches, and even the notes that were leaked were about how he still has a close relationship with Harris. So I think the track record is strong. And I think that that's just another example that Democrats will point to as Joe Biden as a formidable candidate who's not afraid to build a team of rivals.
Kat, have we heard anything from the Republicans on the Harris pick so far?
Yes, and it shouldn't be shocking to see them attacking this pick to frame her as a ultra left wing person that has the potential to one day, presume the role of the president of the United States. So those attacks aren't shocking. And, you know, the days leading up to this election, we saw a lot of women leaders specifically come out and say, look, we are heading into this moment where we know Joe Biden will be selecting a woman. It could be a woman of color, and she will face unprecedented attacks, sexist attacks, racist attacks. And I think in the months that are to come, that is quite honestly going to be what we see. And again, I think it will be up to the media to determine how we frame those things, because again, what Maya was just talking about, you know, some of these concerns that were raised about Harris quote unquote attacking Biden during the course of the primary, would those same questions be asked of a fellow man? Isn't that the course of a debate, a political debate, for someone to question?
I was just going to say, it was a debate, right? Were we expected yes. to be nice in a debate? I'm just confused. I'm not sure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it's that double standard.
Well, and one of the things I'm wondering, Maya and or Kat, if you want to weigh in here, because I was sort of thinking about this yesterday, that this isn't really, I mean, does it really matter what Republicans say about the ticket? Because I don't believe in this idea that there are still undecided voters right now. If we look at both of the parties, I think we know more or less who the ticket is going to be. I think voters are pretty decided. To me, the question is more, are they going to go to the polls to vote? Is this going to inspire people to get to the polls? Do you see that as well, Maya, Kat?
Yes, I absolutely agree. And that's why I think at the end of the day, Harris was seen as such a smart pick, because what this is going to come down to is support at the margins. And having a Black woman on the ticket has shored up support among one of the strongest voting blocs in the Democratic Party, and that's Black women. And not only will they show up, but they will bring their families. And the one voting bloc that has been really a get for both Democrats and Republicans is that slim margin of young men of color who are not necessarily choosing between voting for Joe Biden or Donald Trump, but between voting and not voting at all, or protest voting for a third party candidate and not voting at all.
Is the protest vote still a thing? I mean, is that still something that people are suggesting in this election in particular?
Well, I hate to bring up Kanye, but I do believe that that is the one person that folks have pointed to as a potential protest vote. Now, I'm not saying that that's a viable pick and that that's even legitimate, but I do think that there is still an element of disenfranchisement, particularly among certain slices of the voting of African-American voters and voters of color, who are saying that neither party is really going to do anything for them, particularly at a time where this election is viewed as a referendum not only on Trump, but on public health and on race and policing. I think there has to be now in the next few weeks some real strong effort here to say that this is that there will really be change that comes with a new administration.
Kat, I want to get some really quick. We've got a minute left in the segment here, but wondering if we can just get you said the AP had to think about how to characterize Kamala. Are you confident in the news reporting so far on how she's been framed? Does it look like we're avoiding some of the pitfalls from 2016?
I think out of the gate, I think most media outlets have been careful in how they are characterizing her, how they are describing her. And I think as we move forward, it will be important for us to make an effort to ask her herself, how do you identify? How would you like us to describe your heritage? I think that is crucial in reporting to prevent us from making some of the same mistakes that we did in 2016. The media really has to take an honest look at how we are covering communities of color.
Kat Stafford of the Associated Press, Maya King of Politico. Thanks to you both for this excellent conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, this is Carolyn from Delaware. I think she's excellent, and I think she's excellent because she's smart, tenacious, she's confident, and she has an infectious laugh. She relates well with people, but she's also a person that doesn't back down when she is challenged by man. Diverse backgrounds or have lived a variety of places seem to have a better grasp on the world and the human condition.
Hi, this is George from Berkeley, Massachusetts. My first choice would have been Susan Rice. I think she would have been great. However, Kamala Harris is great as well. I think she'd make a great vice president and, who knows, a pretty formidable president if she decided to go in that direction.
I live in Woodside, California. And even though Kamala Harris is my representative, I have to say I'm really disappointed. I was hoping for Val Demings. You know, California is not a challenge for Joe Biden. Florida is. I just don't know where this choice came from. And once again, I'm dismayed because we're not listening. We're not listening to people of color or white people that are in the lower socioeconomic strata.
I think Kamala Harris is an excellent choice for vice president. That is who I would have picked for Mr. Biden. She brings strength and diversity to the ticket, something the White House is sorely lacking right now. This is Johnny, Kona, Hawaii.
This is Lucy Flores calling from Los Angeles, California. It's very clear from the top Democrats that they're sending a message that their values and their strategy doesn't include expanding the progressive left. And for the sake of this country, I think we all need to pray that enough of the moderate middle gets excited about this.
While the political world was abuzz about Kamala Harris yesterday, five states held primary elections: Minnesota, Vermont, Connecticut, Wisconsin, and Georgia. Because of the coronavirus pandemic, many people in these states chose to cast their ballots by mail. But with the U.S. Postal Service facing a crisis, it may be a while before all of the votes are counted. Amy Gardner is a national political reporter at The Washington Post, and she joins me now. Amy, how are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me.
Busy, busy day yesterday. Let's talk about the nature of these primaries. Were they significant primaries? They seem to have kind of, you know, a lot of us, I think, barely registered a blip of this. So are they big deal or not so much?
It depends. There's a range. Yes and no. Georgia had a really interesting congressional primary in the northwest corner of the state where a woman won her Republican primary who supports the QAnon conspiracy theory. And it's such a Republican district that she's pretty much a shoo-in to Congress. So that's pretty interesting. And there were some interesting local races. Fulton County, which is where Atlanta is, had a pretty contested primary for district attorney. And what was interesting about that isn't so much that it was of national interest politically, but that it brought out voters, which allowed the country to see how Atlanta did on a runoff after having botched the primary itself back in June.
And of course, we mentioned that we're holding elections in the middle of a global pandemic. You know, we mentioned that people are sending in mail-in ballots. What was the in-person turnout in different states? Was it pretty strong?
It was actually incredibly low, but that's not to say that overall turnout was low. There was a crush of absentee ballots. A lot of folks, for instance, in Georgia, again, received absentee ballots in the mail because they requested them for the original primary on June 9th. And some states, including Georgia, allow you, when you request a ballot, to check a box that indicates that you want a ballot for every subsequent election that year. So when some of the contests from that primary went to runoffs yesterday, those voters got ballots automatically, and they turned them in. Upwards of 300,000 absentee ballots were already received by local election officials before Tuesday, but the in-person voting was a trickle. Those are not huge numbers compared to what we're going to see on November 3rd, of course, but still significant numbers to watch how the election officials managed, how they processed the ballots, how long it took them to count, and those kinds of problems or issues that where we saw problems in previous elections this year.
Wondering whether the in-person turnout might have also, had anything to do with just fatigue, the weather, the virus. Like, were those other things that made people want to stay home, you think?
I mean, it's hard to know why people stayed home because we didn't talk to folks who stayed home, but we did talk to people who turned out, including some who turned out reluctantly. There's still tremendous concern about coronavirus infection among folks who are coming out to vote. There is also a new concern that I think is very important to watch as we head toward November, which is declining faith in the Postal Service to deliver ballots on time. The Postal Service is going through a pretty tumultuous period. There's a lot of upheaval. There are a lot of political accusations that President Trump is orchestrating this to undermine the post office, to undermine absentee balloting, although no evidence. So we've registered from voters concern of that they can't trust the Postal Service right now. And I think that concern could be an important factor to watch as we head towards November 3rd.
Let's sort of break this down pretty quickly. We talked a little bit about what happened in Georgia, but tell me what happened in Minnesota.
Representative Ilhan Omar, she won soundly. It's not complete, the count, but as of press time for us, she had 57% of the vote. So,
is that a rebuke, Amy, to a lot of her critics and including the president, who I think a lot of folks assume that this wasn't going to go beyond one term?
Her voters are happy with her. And I think that is a rebuke of the idea that she's out of step with her party and out of step with her voters. Congress is this multicolored quilt, and her critics thought she didn't belong there. And there's obviously undertones of racism and anti-Muslim sentiment and gender discrimination, too. But the fact is that her constituents think she did. And that is a reminder of what Congress is and is supposed to be in our country.
Amy, what about Connecticut? I mean, what was the latest with that primary?
So Connecticut was struggling mightily last week about whether it was going to be able to pull off running its primary yesterday. Hurricane Isaias went through the metro region, as you know, in New York, and there were rampant power outages across Connecticut, which actually froze postal service. Here's a situation where there was a postal delay that was not that was not the fault of the post office or management decisions therein. But it did cause delays, which in turn created some fears about whether ballots would be received on time through no fault of voters. And that was compounded by the fact that local election officials sent out their final batch of 20,000 ballots only last Tuesday, right when this delay was about to hit. As a result of that, the governor of Connecticut, a Democrat named Ned Lamont, signed an executive order, I believe just on Monday, that extended the deadline for ballots to be received. So instead of having to be received by yesterday, the ballots must be postmarked by yesterday, but they can be received as late as Thursday. So we won't see results, final results, until later in the week.
I want to go back to Georgia for a second, Amy, because Marjorie Taylor Greene is in Georgia. She's a QAnon supporter who won her first primary for Congress. How big of a deal is that?
I think that it's fairly limited what the victory says about support for QAnon. I think that's an incredibly Republican district, Georgia 14th. It may show how little voters know about QAnon. She wasn't running on QAnon. She was running as a conservative. And to me, what's more interesting is what her voice will add in Congress and whether she will lean in to some of these conspiracy theories that QAnon supporters espouse. And they're pretty, far out there, including accusations that Democrats run child sex rings, trafficking children for sex, worshiping Satan. I mean, it's some pretty out there stuff that I think average middle-of-the-road voters would not be comfortable with. But that makes me speculate that most voters don't even know what QAnon is.
Are these primaries, Amy, an indication of what may be to come in November?
Yes and no. Turnout was nothing approaching what we're going to see on November 3rd. We're talking about tens of millions of more votes cast than we saw. And so to the extent that two of the states yesterday that had tricky primaries earlier in the year, Georgia and Wisconsin, the verdict was pretty good. There was tremendous preparation in order to right the ship that was sinking badly during those earlier contests. I mean, Milwaukee, for instance, on April 7th, opened 5 precincts for in-person voting, a city that normally opens 180. And we saw those lines on television. People waited in line for 7 hours. And yesterday, they opened 170 out of 180 precincts in Milwaukee. And it was a very similar portrait of what we saw in Fulton County, where Atlanta is, in Georgia. Those preparations are now going to be in full swing for November. And I think there's some really positive signs out of yesterday that there are election officials at the state and local level out there who are working pretty hard to get everything in place. It's just that it was such a small turnout that it's hard for it to be a true test, a stress test of how this will go when tens of millions of voters are casting their ballots.
Amy Gardner is a national political reporter for The Washington Post. Amy, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
People who move to New York always make the same mistake. They can't see the place. This is true of Manhattan, but even the outer boroughs too, be it Flushing Meadows in Queens or Red Hook in Brooklyn. They come looking for magic, whether evil or good, and nothing will convince them it isn't here. This wasn't all bad, though. Some New Yorkers had learned how to make a living from this error in thinking. Charles Thomas Tester, for one.
That was author Victor Lavalle reading from his 2016 novella, The Ballad of Black Tom. Victor wrote the story as a way of responding directly to H.P. Lovecraft, a writer from the early 20th century, whose influence can still be detected throughout the fantasy and horror genres today.
I was about 11 the first time I started reading him, and one of like the central themes of his writing for me is about feeling small and powerless and sort of being enraged at the universe's indifference to your will. And that feels a lot like being 11 years old. And so there was a way that I felt like really connected to the characters he was writing about, except of course they were grown men acting that way and I was 11.
But once Victor got older, he discovered a much more troubling side of Lovecraft.
At around 15 or 16 though, when I reread these stories that I had devoured without any sort of critical lens, I suddenly noticed all these ways that he would just outright say racist and anti-Semitic things, and I was just shocked at what I hadn't seen when I was younger or what I'd glossed over when I was a kid. But in my teenage years, it was no longer possible to sort of just overlook that stuff.
Today, Lovecraft's bigotry is well documented, which has inspired a new generation of fantasy and horror writers to grapple with that legacy in their own fiction.
I first read Lovecraft when I was a teenager, and I just quite loved it. I had read Edgar Allan Poe, so he was the second horror writer that I read. and was one of the writers that got me both into horror and to the early pulp fiction of the what we would call the weird masters. So he was kind of like a gateway drug.
That's Silvia Moreno-Garcia, another author who has re-examined Lovecraft in her work. This weekend, the series Lovecraft Country premieres on HBO, and it's based on a book by writer Matt Ruff, which takes place in the Jim Crow South and combines Lovecraftian horror with the actual terrors of racism. Ahead of the show's release, I spoke with Victor and Silvia to get a sense of why so many writers, particularly writers of color, are engaging with Lovecraft today. And Silvia started off by explaining how she first learned about Lovecraft's racism.
Later on in my late teens, I started reading not just his stories, but kind of his biographical work that had been done on him and his letters, because he had a vast network of correspondence. And so it's one thing to read his stories, and some of them don't have racial stuff that sticks out very clearly. Some of them do. But if you read, for example, The Color Out of Space, well, that's just a color out of space and that kind of stuff. So some of them don't have things that you can see very clearly. Others have more explicit stuff. But when you read some of his letters are very funny and very friendly. Like, he likes ice cream a lot. And then you get to the parts where he's talking to Robert E. Howard, and he's talking about kind of like superior and inferior races. And that's when you realize, like, oh, okay, well, that explains some things that you read maybe in the stories and that you didn't quite get. But I didn't quite get a lot of things in the beginning. And for example, I was pretty surprised that it wasn't until I was doing my thesis, I think because of the translation that I read in Spanish, when I was doing my thesis in my 30s about Lovecraft, I realized that a character in the Dunwich Horror is described as black, as the black brat, Lavini's black brat. And it's a Rosemary's Baby kind of story, where in the end, the paternity of this person turns out to be half supernatural, half human. But I had never clued on to the fact that this child is described as swarthy, as black, that it is probably a metaphor for a mixed race African-American child. And I didn't realize that when I first read it. I think maybe it was a translation. I think it might have been translated as Moreno, which is my last name, as, you know, brown instead of black. But yeah, when I read it again in English, I was like, okay, I missed that one.
Victor, in 2016, you published a novella called The Ballad of Black Tom, which is directly based on a Lovecraft story called The Horror at Red Hook. Why that story in particular? Why did you choose to reimagine Lovecraft in that way?
Well, there were two reasons for using that story. And the first is that most of Lovecraft's stories take place in New England. And I'm a kid from Queens, New York. I don't know anything about New England. And so I didn't feel like I could challenge him as a writer on his home turf. But The Horror at Red Hook takes place in Red Hook, Brooklyn. And if you read it, you can tell he doesn't know a thing about New York or a thing about Brooklyn beyond maybe some street names. And so I felt like, okay, this is my territory. I think I have a little greater mastery about like the landscape and the people. And then the second reason is because it's probably his most overtly and extensively xenophobic story. It's anti everybody and every kind of immigrant, every kind of whatever you want to name that is not a white male Protestant. There's got to be a line in there denigrating that group. And so I really thought like, well, this is the one that is the sort of concentrated dose of Lovecraft's worst impulses. So this is the one I want to wrestle with.
Silvia, you've edited anthologies of stories inspired by Lovecraft. I wonder if any of the writers of color that were contributing to these anthologies were even conflicted about contributing to an anthology inspired by Lovecraft, who, you know, as we said, was xenophobic and had other issues.
There were a few people who, when I asked them, they were concerned, like, as in, well, does my story have to place Lovecraft, or does it have to be a Lovecraft pastiche? And my answer always was, no, it doesn't. It doesn't have to be. And when you think about something like Shakespeare, we have multiple adaptations and retakes of Hamlet, and nobody believes, oh, well, we have to do it exactly like Shakespeare did. So it was the same idea. I would just tell them Lovecraft is a launching point. Would you might be interested in that? And then most people, or I think everybody actually said, yeah, I would like to do that. And they went in wildly different directions. Some were using queer characters, some were using characters of color, some were doing things that were funny, comedic, which Lovecraft wouldn't have done, and some were going in very bleak places and very serious explorations of race and history and womanhood and sexism and all these kinds of things. So it was just this Lovecraft. The good thing about Lovecraft's mythos and Lovecraft's fiction is that it has been for many, many decades. It's like a Lego kit. You know, you can grab the Lego blocks and you can build a spaceship, but somebody else can build a castle.
I have a question for both of you. Why even bother trying to find inspiration from Lovecraft today rather than just leaving him behind entirely and allowing people, you know, and just creating your own stories without any contact with Lovecraft? I mean, is he that critical to the genre, or just curious? Sylvia.
Literature is a conversation between authors and between books. And there's just some people that keep getting our attention for some reason or another. There's something that they said there that still speaks to us. And I think Lovecraft, unlike other writers who have been forgotten of the time period, really does say things that jive with our modern experience. Not only, you know, the questions about living in a world that is phantomless and unforgiving and where your life might have no meaning, but also the fact that some of his stories are peppered with issues of race, I think is why we keep looking at him, because he is one of the writers that actually has that baked into the story, and we can actually use those blocks to build something new. You can't do that with other writers so easily.
Victor, what about you? Why even bother using Lovecraft as a starting point or an inspiration? Why not just, you know, create things without having to refer back to him?
I guess I would think of, I often think of literature as a kind of an enormous family, right? The books you read when you're young, the books that influence you, the artists that influence you, they get into your DNA. They become a part of your sort of way of thinking and seeing the world. And as a result, they influence who you are in the same way that they were influenced. I would echo Sylvia that Lovecraft didn't invent the genre of cosmic horror. There are artists that were inspiring him, like Algernon Blackwood, Arthur Machen, whose work is still read. But he added to that genre. And to my mind, the worst thing would be to say, that kind of writing or that genre, it's only for white dudes. Because when I was growing up, I said, I love this. I knew lots of writers of color, lots of women who also love this. And so the idea that we would have to give up a whole sort of geography simply because someone who was a big part of it was a problem, I mean, I feel like then you'd have to talk about realism and Herman Melville. You'd have to talk about almost every single genre. Some of the writers who are foundational were also awful people. And so the question is, do we give up everything, or do we find a way to revitalize it, regenerate it, and perhaps make something good out of some land that was at times a little bit poisoned or a little bit fallow? Let's say it that way.
Sylvia, wanted to ask you about this summer's Hugo Awards, which honor science fiction and fantasy writing, where Lovecraft got a retroactive award. What did you make of the decision to do that?
I think all the retro awards are ridiculous. Why do we care what somebody did, you know, 80 years ago when they were extremely famous, as in the case of H.P. Lovecraft? It's not adding anything to recognize him at this point. I mean, he is dead. Shouldn't we be looking at other people who are alive and well and maybe didn't get as much attention? I mean, I remember when Charles Saunders wrote what is a rip-roaring African sword and sorcery in the 1970s and 80s, and it kind of was not very well known, that those are the kind of people that I would like to see and getting awards. I mean, there's like board games inspired by Lovecraft's work. There's a film festival. Why does he need that award? And of course, you know, this coming after they changed the World Fantasy Award from being a Lovecraft head, a Howie, to something else. It just feels really quite pointless. And if we are going to be doing that kind of looking into the past and giving awards like that, we should be doing it, you know, to more interesting people that were forgotten.
Wondering, Victor, if you can recommend any sci-fi or fantasy writers today who are tackling things like racism and sexism in their work. Is there anyone you would recommend?
Yeah, for sure. There's a few. There's a writer named Ruthanna Emrys, has a series of books that starts with a novel called Winter Tide that talks about Lovecraft stuff, particularly from the point of view of women in the Lovecraftian sort of fictional world. There's a writer named Cassandra Caw, who has a novel called Hammers on Bone. And then a writer named Caitlin Kiernan, who has a novel called Agents of Dreamland. All three of them are excellent writers and wrote excellent books in this sort of vein.
Sylvia, are there any sci-fi or fantasy writers today that you would want to recommend?
Stephen Graham Jones just released The Only Good Indians. I think it is an excellent novel that has all the flavor of Stephen King, It, or Peter Straub's Ghost Story, but it feels fresh and exciting. I also read a book in translation recently that is called Tender is the Flesh. It's a dystopia in which human beings are being farmed for meat consumption. So those are just two horror books that have come out recently that I think are very exciting. And there's always interesting work going on in the magazines, in the small presses. Nadia Balkan's collection, She Said Destroy, is just amazing. And there's all kinds of stuff that is happening. That I think if you like horror, we are, I hope, kind of entering a sort of renaissance after it being kind of dry out there, where horror wasn't getting as much attention in the literary sphere, and you would be told, well, don't write horror, it'll never sell. I think we're finally heading into an era in which that might not be true anymore.
Don't write horror, it'll never sell if you're not Stephen King, or don't write horror, it'll never sell because people aren't interested?
Well, I was told don't write anything set in Mexico because nobody will read anything in Mexico. So if you want to get more specific about my situation, that was mine. But in general, I was also told that horror is not something that agents or editors would like. And it is true. It's one of those things that you don't see agents kind of running out and begging you for horror books. There were other things that they might want, like epic fantasy was kind of the big thing patented after George R. R. Martin and Game of Thrones. That was kind of like the hot stuff that people were kind of asking. And if you said, well, I've got a horror book, it's like, okay. And then if I said it's set in Mexico, then they were just like, well, no, that's definitely no.
I suspect that might be starting to change, Sylvia.
Well, I wrote a book called Mexican Gothic, and it's a New York Times bestseller, so I just thought that'll show them.
Victor Laval is the author of The Changeling, and Sylvia Moreno-Garcia is the author of Mexican Gothic. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that's all for us, folks. Thanks so much for listening. If you missed anything, please remember we have a podcast, and you can find that wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, you can call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. You can tweet me at Tanzina Vega. Thanks so much for spending your day with us. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.